The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
Good evening. In the last session that we had here 2 weeks ago, we talked a bit about prevention of problems, strengthening our children, avoiding the development of problems. And the idea was that this evening to speak about intervention. When problems begin, when problems seem to be developing, or when they've already spiraled out of control. I might have thought last time that this topic might be a bit, offensive, but I must say that based on discussions and calls and private conversations subsequent to the last session, I certainly think that intervention with, as we call them here, there's a review that you could pick up on your way out, about intervening with the challenges that our children are experiencing. We certainly have our fair share of challenged children or challenges facing our children, even in a wonderful community such as this. And therefore, I think it would be appropriate to deal with some of these general strategies. In terms of the prevention, just to highlight some of the basics, it happens to be that this evening is the Yahrzeit of the Alte von Slabodka. The Alte passed away 82 years ago, and those of us who have a little sense of modern history know that the Olam HaTorah that we have today in this community and throughout the world is in the greatest measure the direct impact of the Alte and his great Talmidim that he had. And it's told, I heard this on good authority, that the Alte, who didn't have much contact with Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, he was more a Talmud Chover, Rabbi Simcha Zisel was a Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael. But at one occasion, he asked Rabbi Yisrael how to make a yeshiva. And he basically quoted for him a very simple formula. Lahachyos nefesh shfolim, lahachyos lev nitkoim. Uplift everybody. People at Tzubrochim. You know, and that was a time then. And we have our own, a different type maybe of Tzubrochimkeit that our children are feeling today. There's something in the air that depresses them, that makes them feel that something is missing in their lives. They don't feel good about themselves. And we could analyze some of the reasons, but that's not really the issue right now. And the mission of the yeshiva, and the mission of a community, and the mission of us as parents, is to uplift these tzubrochene hearts and these tzubrochene souls. And that really, in terms of prevention, and that really in terms of intervention, is really a key. As we mentioned last time, the definition of happiness is a definition of validation, making them feel good about themselves. Anything that we can do to make our children feel good about themselves, especially if it's in the areas of Yiddishkeit, of Torah, of Ruchnius, then we certainly provide them with the formula for happiness, and we become the conduits. We become the means by which they achieve this happiness, and therefore our influence is much increased, and we're in a position to do much more for them. Of course, in that process, we have to be very careful about putting them down. We have to be very careful about providing them with positive experiences, and we discussed a lot of these things last time. A child is challenged. There are problems. They don't seem to be doing well in school. They seem to be, for any one of a number of reasons, what one might call positioned for failure. Positioning doesn't mean that they're going to fail, that they're not going to make it, that things are going to go wrong, they're going to go off the derech, but they're in a precarious position. There's turmoil at home. There was tragedy in the family. There's some type of a mental, psychological issue that they're dealing with. There's some learning disabilities. There's some social problems. They've gotten in with a group of friends that may not be the best influence. They just can't seem to find their place. Now, none of these things and any of the many other problems that children may have necessarily mean that they're going to fail and fall. However, when they are so positioned, our intervention is critical, because if situations, problems, depression, lack of satisfaction or just lack of happiness is existent in our children's lives, then if it's left unattended, then little by little it can certainly lead to much more serious, difficult problems. And for the most part, those of the youth today that have gone far off the derech, it has usually started with something relatively simple, relatively small, not in every case, and more often than not, something that we could have done something about. One of the biggest challenges for parents is when a child begins to act inappropriately. I think they had this week in the Chinuch Roundtable in the Yated about the kid who seems to be doing well in yeshiva and everything is fine, except Shabbos he doesn't get up for the minyan. You know, and a challenge. And when we deal with a challenge, very often our response, our initial response to that challenge, can determine whether the challenge is going to be eventually removed, overcome, or whether it's just going to be a stepping stone to worse problems. And one of the things that I think is very critical, not getting into that specific issue, is the love and respect and the close relationship that we maintain, the unconditional love and the belief that this child will succeed and overcome any problems, have to be absolute. And it's so easy to give in on these things when the kid isn't behaving. He's not getting up for minyan. He's not doing well in school. He doesn't want to learn. He's hanging out with a kid that I think he shouldn't be. His language is becoming a little bit disrespectful. And these are serious issues. And they have to be dealt with. But dealing with the issues should not compromise in any way the love, and I'm making sure I don't leave out one word, the love and the respect, the close relationship, the unconditional love, and that conviction, that showing this child that we believe in him or her and they are going to succeed. Now, that's difficult because they're not behaving properly. Something's wrong. And Yiddishkeit means so much to me. You missed his man Krishma. You missed a minion. You spoke inappropriately. You're not behaving properly at the Shabbos table. The Rebbe said that the learning is not what it used to be. You're hanging out a little bit, not too bad, but with the wrong friends. Your dress is becoming a little bit just not exactly the way it should be. Not terrible. It's beginning. And it's critical. In fact, I dare say, and oftentimes it's true, that oftentimes what our children are doing by veering ever so slightly from the appropriate behavior or dress or talk or derech or commitment to learning is testing our love. Do we love our children because they're going in our derech? Because they're going to bring glory to our name and our mishpocha's name? Or do we love our children for who they are, not what they do? And that's so critical, whether a kid understands this consciously or subconsciously. But it's so, so critical. And they have to see that my love, my respect, my connection, my relationship with you has nothing to do with the way you behave. That doesn't mean that I don't attempt to improve the behavior. However, one wishes to discuss inappropriate behavior. The worst time to do it is alteratze odem b'shas kasu, is b'shas that behavior is manifest. The worst time, because everything is against it. The defenses are up. I'm not thinking rationally. I can't hear what you're talking about. It doesn't go in. It doesn't penetrate. And we have to learn, and it's not an easy skill to learn, the ability to patiently await the right moment. Now, if you want a radical, extreme dugma of patiently awaiting the right moment, just to share with you, I mentioned it's the Alter's Yahrzeit. I heard this from Reb Yitzchok Hutner, Zecherei Livracha. He said that there was once a Rav that had learned in Slabodka, came back to the yeshiva many years later, and it was a Shabbos, and they gave him an aliyah, like a Pesach Hamishi or something like that. And at the end of the davening, he comes up to the altar to say good Shabbos, and the altar says to him, "You, a miskabit bekloin chaveroi, you mon kovit?" He didn't know what hit him. Like, what? What did I do? How did I mon kovit? How am I miskabit bekloin chaveroi? And he says, 25 years ago, when you were a bocher in the yeshiva, there was another bocher, an Iluyisha bocher, who became one of the famous Rosh Yeshivas later on. And he walked into the Beis Medrash on Shabbos morning. He was standing in the back, and the altar was in the front. And this bocher that got the chamishi was near the altar. And this Iluyisha bocher started taking off his jacket, ki'ilu, to put on tefillin. He was, it was fatracht. He forgot it was Shabbos. And the altar wanted to save him the embarrassment. And he sent this bocher, run, and stop him, remind him. You walked a little bit too slowly. You wanted the Olam to have a little hanor. He waited 25 years. Don't wait 25 years to speak to your kids because, it'll be too late by then. 25 years for the right opportunity when he thought at that moment he was unhappy. I guess he sensed he was unhappy with the chamishi, So he said, he's unhappy with the chamishi. Well, now I can get him for... Now he's ready to hear what I had to say for 25 years later. So timing is very important. The ability to hold back, sometimes not to see things. One of the biggest gifts in life as a parent or a teacher is to know what not to see. And then to come back at a time, maybe at a time when we're unusually close, maybe at a time when we're having an ice cream together, maybe at a time when there's some positive bonding that exists. And at that time to talk never about what you did wrong, but only about the topic in general, so that he hears and discovers that, hey, this kind of behavior is not appropriate, and it works wonders. It works so much better. That's something that I think is very important to keep in mind. But in that process of discussion, there's a key word that we have learnt to ignore, and that word is listen. We don't listen enough. We talk, we lecture, we chastise, we're moichiach, we rebuke, we put down, we criticize, but we don't listen. We have to listen, because listening to me is what validates me. What validates me here this evening? Few people are here to listen. If not, I don't feel good about myself. It's very simple. You're listening to me. My father, my mother, they listen when I talk. They have a right to disagree. Yes, our children will grant us the right to disagree. That's very magnanimous of them. But they will grant us the right to disagree if and when we listen. But we have to listen. And listening means, I don't like he's starting to say this nonsense, this, ateretz, adaba, bubba. Doesn't matter. Quiet, patiently. In fact, most times, unless it's really, really unbearable, you shouldn't even disagree or comment. Rather, but I have a different perspective, and for my experience, and for what I think, and for what I know, and always for your benefit. not for the neighbors and not for the shidduchim and not for my reputation and not for my ego and not for your grandparents and not for anything, just for your benefit. And that's maybe we get a chance, a shot at influencing them when their behavior is beginning to change if we indulge and engage in these types of attitudes. When there's a problem, we tend to pressure. In fact, probably one of the most tragic errors, I believe, that parents make is we think we actually have some control over our children. Who would guess the age when we lose control of our children? I'm waiting for someone to say 3, 5, 7. Very minimal control we have. By the time they hit the teenage years, forget it. We have influence. We have their ear. We have their purse strings. And we should know how to manipulate those purse strings and use them, some people call it bribe them, to achieve that which we want. But we don't control them. Forget it. Get rid of that notion. It's a terrible, tragic mistake that parents make because they think they can control the kids. They try to control the kids, and the kids just laugh. Right? Okay, maybe in front of you I'll behave a little bit, put up a pretext, but it doesn't work. And we have to be able to influence them. Part of the realization that we don't control them is we must limit the pressure. If I had to guess, and this is only guesswork and I can't claim any authoritative basis for this, that the most common underlying factor in most normal kids with normal problems, without terrible trauma or tragic things that are going on in their families or in their lives, most normal kids that get challenged and drift off a little bit, pressure is the key word. The pressure that these kids feel to conform, the pressure that these kids feel to be perfect, the pressure that these kids feel to do everything that they're supposed to. I may have mentioned it last time, but you know, the adult generation has learned how to cheat, has learned how to compromise, has learned how to get tzachanitza, we find that people look at me askance, maybe not in this community, nobody does that, I don't know. But for the most part, kids are pure. And purity creates even greater pressure. Because I take everything seriously. I have to do it 100%. And it's overwhelming. And I can't. And there's so many temptation. And there's so many problems. And there's so many... And you know what happens when there's too much pressure? Sometimes you just give up. And you have to limit pressure. You have to put them at ease for the pressure. Don't feel so much pressure. Don't worry so much. Do the best you can. All that HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks of you is to be yourself and to do the best you can. Reducing pressure can oftentimes turn a kid around because they were so pushed and they were so crushed and they were so overwhelmed. And with this reversal, sometimes it can make all of the difference. One of the things that we don't like to do as parents, and one of the things that we must do as parents, and especially if a kid is rebelling, in a sense, against our rules, our expectations, our regulations, is to explain them. The pressure of unexplained rules, because I said so, is devastating. You know, our kids, especially when they reach the age of 6, 7, they think they have as much brains as their parents. By 12, they're convinced that they're much smarter. And because you say so is not enough of a hechruch for me to do anything. And you know something? Steht geschrieben in the Torah doesn't help much either. In fact, that in the previous century, that was probably one of the biggest turnoffs to Yiddishkeit. When they asked why I can't do this and why I got to do that. And it's true. It's the ultimate truth. But they have to have some sense of there's reason for it. And to a little kid, even if he has no or she has no idea of what the reason that you're talking, you tell him the whole reason. I don't know what you're talking about. But there's a reason. Oh, okay. Feels better already. And to an older kid. Now, they may disagree with your reason. They probably will. But at least it's reasonable. At least you're coming at them. It isn't just rules for the sake of rules. It isn't just force for the sake of force and structure for the sake of structure. But somebody really believes, and of course we have to represent that, and we have to believe it, that it's for their benefit. This is something that is expected of me for my benefit, and this is why, and this is how. It makes all the difference in the world. Discipline. You know, when challenges begin and we see our kids a little bit shaky in their commitments, we try to exert more discipline. You know, we're going to teach them a lesson. We're going to show them. We're going to, they didn't get it yet, and we're going to make sure. And I may have mentioned this, but I'm fond of saying it over and over again. The sheirish of the word discipline is disciple. It's about teaching, not forcing. It's all about teaching. If the message doesn't get across, we didn't successfully discipline our children. And that's really what we have to keep in mind. Punishment. We seem to have gotten into a world that is very, very big on punishment. And we forget the fact that punishment is also to teach a lesson. Laman yishmu v'yiro. It's to convey a certain message. It isn't for us to play as if we were the representatives of the Bezin Shel Malo, and even the punishments of the Bezin Shel Malo. G'deilu ha'soras ha'tabas yoysu v'mem ches neviyim is also just to teach us, just like the Novi taught us at Derech, so too the Yisurim are to teach us at Derech. To teach, it's all about getting a lesson across. The most effective way to convince anyone to do anything is positive reinforcement. Give them positive things rather than punishments. Encouragements, as I mentioned before, some call it bribes. But rewards, reinforcement, behavior, good behavior is appreciated and reinforced with a reward, something that you could appreciate that shows that I recognize as a parent that you're doing the right thing, that I appreciate as a parent that you're making an effort, and that I want to show you as a parent how much I appreciate it to encourage you to continue behaving this way. And sometimes even when there are very difficult situations, this type of an attitude can make all the difference in the world. I'd like to take a moment to discuss something else. Our children often fool us. I'm not talking about lying and concealing from us. But they often fool us about the level of receptivity that they have. They put on sometimes such a hardened front. They seem sometimes so disinterested. Disinterested in talking to us, disinterested in what we have to say, disinterested in doing what's right and in the relationship. They have no time for us. We want to spend time with them. We want to show them how much we care. They don't want. They recall. They run away. They hide. They're not interested. And sometimes, tragically, we buy it. And we think, it's true. I had just this morning in my office a situation. It was a blended family. You know, one parent had passed away, a remarriage, and so forth. And the woman's son was totally negative and resistant, but in a very almost like offensive, if not worse, way to this stepfather, this new father, whatever. And father was ready to give up. He says, this kid, just he mistreats me. He's not interested in talking to me. He's just, I can't deal with him. I try to help him. I try to be good. I try to give him. I try this. And he just rejects me. And I realized from the conversation that this kid was just hollishing for a relationship. He never had one with a father. His father was out of his life early on. And he didn't know how to get it. And he wanted that he shouldn't have to beg for it. He shouldn't have to. And the father really was a nice guy. He said, just ask me and I'll be glad to help you. And he couldn't ask him for anything. Just show a little appreciation. I'll be glad to do anything for you. Couldn't do it. Because he had to have this feeling. He so wanted that relationship. He had to have this feeling that this man cares for him. This man is running after him. The more that he was negative to the relationship, and this is in a different kind of a family, but it applies all across the board, the more it indicates that he really wants it. Let's not be fooled. The truth of the matter is, I heard already from them that they use a certain approach and, you know, things have started to turn around already because that's all the kid wants. Our kids want relationships with us. Parents are the most important people in the lives of their children for as long as their children live, for as long as their parents live, as long as both live. However, they ain't going to show it. And we have to be smart enough to see through the negativity as a test of love, as a call for help, as a call of distress, but never, never to be turned off and turned away because they seem so disinterested in what we have to say and what we have to offer. However, what we say and what we offer has to be in a positive, loving, caring, respectful, listening, validating, so forth and so on way. A kid's drifting. And as parents, we just don't seem to be able to reach the kid. Sometimes kids get a little bit immune to parents. Sometimes parents don't have the ability to implement all of these suggestions. Sometimes we think, as parents, that we're being very kind, very respectful, very nice, very loving to our kids. And if you ask the kid, and he'll tell you it's just the opposite. They have two completely different perceptions. What can we do? Well, probably one of the wisest things that we could do is to develop some type of older peer mentoring. Mentoring is a wonderful thing because mentoring involves a person who's not a parent, who isn't as subjective, who isn't as emotionally involved, who isn't as hurt and distraught and insulted and offended by everything that this kid may be doing. And it's also a person whose interest in our child does more to validate our child than does the parental care, concern, and love. We may have mentioned this last time because kids are not all that validated by parental love, although it helps and although the opposite can devastate them. But the reason they're not all that validated is because my mother, that's her job. My parents are supposed to love me. They're programmed to love me. They're paid to love me. So it doesn't make me feel so good about myself that I'm so choshev because they love me. But a mentor, somebody a couple years older, a guy or a girl that's a little bit with it, that seems to have some sprach with these kids, you know, someone that they could look up to, things, common interests, and they've succeeded in these common areas of interest. And this person is spending time with me? Wow. My stocks go up in my own eyes. I feel choshev. And if you're paying that mentor, just don't let your kids see, oh, come on, I got to pay you, please. Not in front of the kids. They should never know that. So they should feel that, you know. And there are a lot of people around. There are a lot of yeshiva kids, girls, boys, that are willing to spend some time with younger kids, and they could do so much for them. They can communicate with them and influence them in areas that we as parents or mechanchim would never be able to. Sometimes we need professional help. You know, there was a tkufa in our communities where mi'itenli psychologist or mental health professional v'ashchenu kenochosh, like Rabbi Akiva said, you know. There was a bit of hatred, distrust, and rightly so. Rightly so, because these people, many of them, were hurting our children more, probably, than they may have been helping them. Today, Baruch Hashem, there are many professionals with professional training and expertise who in their own lives are b'nei Torah, and they certainly espouse the similar hashkofas to the community that they service, and these people can be of great help. Oftentimes, a child that's very different, let's say, from everyone else of his peers, needs some type of an evaluation. You know, there are psychological evaluations and psychiatric evaluations. There's behavioral things, and there are things that seem to be chemical, seem to be, you know, beyond just the simple behavioral. And there are people who are capable of evaluating these kids, and we have to be very careful who we turn to. We have to be very meticulous to check these people out to make sure that they're not only qualified, but that they're sensitive and intelligent and insightful enough, and of course sympathetic and open enough to deal with these issues and communicate with us as well. They have to know how to keep their confidence, the confidence of the children, yet they have to know at what point they have to bring parents into the situation. And what we do find such people, an evaluation and sometimes counseling can be a very helpful thing. Many families are in need of family counseling. Family counseling means that one member of the family and the parents may not be getting along. Everybody else may be doing fine, but everybody is really part of it, in a sense, tangentially related. And there are professionals that specialize in family counseling, just helping families to get it together, to be able to better cope, to know how to deal with issues and problems, to come to certain agreements for standards and appropriate behaviors and respect of the space and parameters of each other. And that's something which is oftentimes very, very appropriate. Here's a hard one. Our kids have complaints. You know, oftentimes when things are not going well for us, as adults and certainly as children, the first thing we look to do is to blame somebody. You know, some of us just blame anyone who's within range. Sometimes the kid, it's the Rebbe's fault, it's the teacher's fault, it's the principal's fault, it's the kids in the class's fault, it's my parents' fault, it's this fault, it's that. Everybody has a blame. When the blame is leveled high up, like at a parent or like at a Rebbe, a teacher, sometimes we are in conflict in terms of how to respond. Do I agree or do I disagree? Do I acknowledge the criticism that my child has or do I not? Well, the first question is it valid or isn't it? But if it's valid, if there is some validity to it, sometimes the only way we're ever going to break this cycle of inappropriate response and reaction to this relationship or this person or this stimulus or this type of treatment. The only way we're ever going to do that is first to be able to validate the complaint that the child has. Now, this is controversial. This is painful. But it's very significant. Because if, let's say, for example, take an extreme example, a child is being abused on some level, and this happens too, and the parent denies it. It can't be. Not in this community, not in this school, not with such a reputable teacher or rebbe. It can't be. Impossible. The lessons that the child internalizes from that denial, the negative lessons, are overwhelming in and of themselves. Because first of all, I see my parent really doesn't care. Because if you cared enough, you'd find out more. Second of all, I see my parent doesn't believe me because I'm telling them that there's a problem. Third of all, I see my parent lies to me because there is a problem and they're denying it. And besides all that, there's a problem that's going to continue to exist and my parent hasn't done anything about it. On the other hand, sometimes all the person who has a complaint needs to hear to turn around his reaction completely is, a very important person in my life has validated my complaint, says, yes, you're right. We must try to do something about it. It does so much for me. It sort of therapeutically reduces, if not removes, the damage. I'm believed, I'm heard, I'm trusted, I'm respected, I'm right, I'm not crazy. So it's a very important nekuda, number one. Number two, if we deny a complaint of our child, if there is any validity to that complaint, then we really have made a very serious error. Because even if, you know, if it's a secular teacher, it's not going to be such a serious thing. If we agreed with the complaint, but even if it was a rebbe, a teacher, someone of spiritual religious stature, but that individual, for the most part, will have influence on our child till the end of the year. It's probably not going to go on long, and if it does, it probably should switch to another school. But we as a parent, we're in it for the long run. So what I've taught my kid is that this teacher, who the kid knows in his heart of hearts is not behaving properly, is right, you're wrong, I'm a liar, I've ruined the relationship and the respect for the one who's much more critical in the life of that child because of the fact that I'm here for the long run. Now, this doesn't sit well with many people, but it has to be done in a very respectful way. And the way that it's done is, you know, yes, I agree with you. You have a valid complaint. Of course, the teacher, the Rebbe, the so-and-so doesn't mean anything bad by it. It's a mistake. They don't realize how sensitive you are. They don't realize how you're internalizing this message. They don't realize this. They don't that. They mean this. They mean that. But you cannot look the other way and ignore and disenfranchise the child when in reality you believe, and you can't jump to conclusions that, you know, that's another thing. Oftentimes kids imagine things and you have to do your research, you have to find out. But if you do believe, as I mentioned before, that this child is in fact right, you have to in some way validate that that complaint. I must tell you, and you know, I'm talking about years of experience with some of the most difficult off the derech nicks, if you will. Early on in my experience, had one young man who was at the time and probably over the years still maintained one of the records for one of the most difficult, challenging, literally challenging every moment of the day and night. Young man, he was maybe 14 years old at the time. Baruch Hashem, today he's wonderful. And the key that he taught me was that when I asked him how did he start to change and what happened, he says, "You believed in me." That's all. Our kids, if they see that we believe in them, it uplifts them, it energizes them. It's mechaya nefesh folim. Because we believe in them. It's extremely, extremely. I heard from the Menahel of this venerable Moshe that we're in this evening that something like, there are Menahalim that when students get sent to them for disciplinary reasons, they tend to give the student the feeling that he'll be back or she'll be back tomorrow. In other words, this is the way you are. You're a troublemaker, and let's settle it today, but I'll probably see you again before the end of the week. And he said, the key to chinuch is that when that child is taken into the principal's office, or when that child is confronted by a parent, that the key is that the parent or the menahel or the Rebbe gives off the feeling that, I don't think I'll ever see you again for this offense. This is not you. You're a great person. You're a wonderful person. You did a terrible thing, and it has to be dealt with, but this is not you. This is not who you are. And that sense of who I really am, and giving me that sense of validation, and that I'm somebody good, and I'm expected, and good is expected of me, can make all the difference. There are two other areas which I think are very significant as well. And actually, I have here, it's actually based on a talk that was delivered in this community just the other day, but it's entitled, A 10-Point Plan to Strengthen Emunah in Our Homes. You'll find it out on the table as well. But something that we have to keep in mind as well, and that is, when our kids, in our communities, become challenged in any challenge that directly or indirectly affects their Yiddishkeit, there are two critical realizations which, if they are deeply rooted within them, they will give them the encouragement and the strength and the inspiration to fight forward and persevere. And if they are not deeply rooted within them, then they might chalila just encourage or allow these kids just to give up. And those two things are, one is the amitius ha-Torah, that Torah mi-Sinai is a reality. And to the degree that they recognize that, after everything is said and done, I'm frustrated, it's not working with me, that's not good, I'm not happy, but I know it's true, I've got to make it work. One. And the other one, besides the fact that it's true, they have to be able to see, at least to imagine, to look forward to, the ability that Torah Mi-Sinai has to make my life good. Right now my life is no good. Or in the inimitable words of some of these kids that are challenged, I have no life. That's a very favorite phrase that they have. I have no life. But I know that ultimately it's good. I've seen my parents happy. I've seen other people in the community happy. I know that there's benefits to be derived from every mitzvah of the Torah. I understand that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam has given the Torah to us only for our benefit. And, Agav, it's very interesting. Someone today called me from Eretz Yisrael and quoted me from the Menorah HaMoir, who is brought by the Shalom. And he says as follows. He says, when you're dealing with children, he says, in the earliest stages, you have to give them things that they like. Pleasure, candy, whatever it is. And then he says, when what you've given them is nimas lohem, they get a little bit older, you have to give them something that they appreciate on that level. And when then you give them something that they got on that level and it's nimas lohem, you have to give them something that they can appreciate even more. And when you finally, they have become nimas in all of the pleasures that this world has, then talk to them about Olam Haba and what they're going to get with a life of Torah mitzvahs. Sounds like as long as there's pleasure left that's not nimas lehem in this world, it's premature. That doesn't mean you don't talk about Olam Haba at all. But it's somewhat premature. We have to deal with them in this world. They have to feel that they can find relief and happiness and fulfillment and pleasure in this world, not only in the next world. And oftentimes we make this mistake and we promise them, we say, oh, here it's miserable, here you're going to suffer. Suffering is all to bring you over there. Say, please have rachmonis, it's too long. I'm not interested in waiting so long. I can't handle it. But here we see that as long as there are benefits that can be given, offered to them in this world, those benefits are critical to inspire and to engage and to tempt and to motivate our children to connect. And only when they're beyond that can we really take them to the higher levels. Before we conclude and maybe just have a few moments of questions, if it's appropriate. I've tried to talk about challenges in a very general and vague sense. Well, basically, the discussion has been about whatever different things might be challenging our kids, some general strategies to deal with them and to intervene. But there are two challenges which I wish were not relevant at all, but I think that we have to at least be aware that they are becoming so prevalent in our society today that it's inevitable that they will not, if they have not, and I doubt that they have not yet penetrated our society here. And that's the scourge of substance abuse and the influences of the internet. What these two things do is, I mean, they're all part of the same thing, but they're basically, they are a response to a spiritual void that we feel. And Jewish kids, when they have a spiritual void, the void is deeper than anything that the Goyish Welt could imagine. Because the Goyish Welt, the Neshoma didn't stand by her Sinai. Their standards for good and for happiness are not as critical, are not as serious. They don't have as much to compete with. And you know, you give them whatever you give them and they're happy. Not how much happy, but something. A yid? No, he can never. He can't. Tevim doidecho miyayin, mikol mishte yayin desimcho. They want that dveikus Hashem. They want that true fulfillment. And if they haven't succeeded, and if they're not comfortable, and if they haven't connected with the Borei Olam in their Yiddishkeit, in their learning, in their Shmiras HaMitzvahs, then the void is as big as the hole in the Grand Canyon. And they must fill it up. And today, it's so easy to fill it up. Chemicals, drugs, substances, alcohol, available like nothing. Simplest thing in the world. I'm sure you have a lot of Shalom Zochers in the community here. That's all you need. That's all you need. The average kid, Jewish, frum kid, that gets involved in drugs says that my first encounter, My first substance was offered to me by my father at a kiddush and shul, or by my neighbor at a shalom zocher. Innocent enough, but leads to trouble. And there's so much trouble out there. And even if this community has not experienced the level of problems that so many of our communities are experiencing, and I hope it's true that you haven't, it can't be too far away. And we have to be alert to it. And we have to realize that addiction is a serious illness. They claim that maybe 50% of the population have potentially addictive behavior, addictive personalities. That means that if you get me hooked on an addiction, I'm hooked. If I avoid it for my life, it may lie dormant. But once you hook me on it, it becomes a lifetime battle. We have to be very aware and very careful. We have to be careful ourselves about what we have available to our children. We can't be naive. We have to know that the children have today learned how to find in a medicine chest, innocently enough, stuff that could take them straight to heaven, literally sometimes, Rahman al-Islam, but certainly can get them very high. And it's all because there's a void, and they're looking to fill that void. So we have to help them to fill that void, but we can't be naive to the dangers that exist there. And we have to realize that we need professional help in this area. We have to realize, and the psychologists in our midst should forgive me, that not every psychologist or social worker who may be highly qualified in counseling is familiar enough with the issues of addiction to be able to deal successfully with it, even though they may try. It's a very specialized area. We also have to be aware of the fact that sometimes dealing with it professionally can expose our kids to greater exposure than they've had until now. So we have to balance that. It's a complicated thing, but it's something we have to be aware of. It's a problem. And then, what's that? What I'm referring to is that in many communities, I don't know what the situation is here, but in many communities, the group meetings and programs that they have to deal with addiction are composed not of our kids, but all kinds of people. And even if it's our kids, but sometimes they meet people there that they shouldn't. They find venues of getting even better stuff than they were able to get before. So it's a very, there's no simple solution to this, but it's an awareness that we have to have, and every parent has to be alert to really watch it. When you see, if you see a kid drinking, you gotta be alert, you know? It's a little bit, once in a while, but, you know, and you should watch your, wherever you keep your booze, you know what I mean, the cabinet, and to see if the levels remain the same from week to week, or if your husband or wife seems to be, you know, that's something that kids oftentimes do. We have to be aware. And the same thing applies with this tragic, tragic internet situation. I really, you know, I know that a lot of discussion has been gone on here, but I can only tell you one thing. The internet, the text messaging, and all of these electronic devices for instant communication with people all over the world have posed just a new dimension of threat that we never had before. You know, they say that two kids could be riding home on a bus together, sitting on the same seat, but instead of talking, they're texting. So it's like it's become it's an addiction. It's like, I hope you don't have that here, but it's something, it's right around the corner if it's not here, and you got to be aware of it. So forgive me just for another moment. But the dangers of this instant ability to connect any place in the world, I'd just like to leave you with one of hundreds, if not thousands, of stories. A young lady who was basically a frum young lady was about to get engaged to a goy. And she was frum. She negotiated chinuch for the children and Shabbos and kashrus and everything. She met him innocently over the internet. Because the texting and the internet seemed so harmless. The person was located 10,000 miles away. What could be wrong? Just communication. Just typing. What could happen? Well, from typing, it went to this, it went to a picture, it went to a telephone call, it went to an airplane, it went to a... Miraculously, something happened, and this particular girl, you know, was freed from this terrible matzav. But these are the dangers that exist. So we have to be aware of these dangers. We can't be naive. Most kids know much more about these things than their parents do. And therefore, whatever you hear that, oh, I got it under control, there's this, there's that, there's... Yeah, every little bit helps, but there's no real protection. And therefore, it's something that we just have to be aware of. The only real protection against all of these ravages that exist in our society today is the filling that void with so much meaning, with so much validation, with so much feeling good about themselves, that the need to get involved in any type of addictive behavior. You know, I once had a theory that addiction is like a substitute for purpose. If I don't have a purpose in life, I don't know what my purpose is, so I have a void. An addict has a purpose. Wakes up in the morning, where am I going to get my next fix? That's what the focus of my day is. I know it's a sick purpose, but a tachlis it is. We have to avoid that. And the more we give our kids, and the more we deal early on with their problems, and the more we recognize challenges before they spiral out of control, and get them the help that they need before they become really in danger, the more we'll be able to avoid all of these tragic and difficult challenges, which today, unfortunately, are destroying families, children, individuals, communities. Okay, any... Yes?
Let's say perm is coming up. Let's say you have 11, 12, 13-year-olds in your house. What do you recommend? What perm should be done? How should be done?
Well, you know, your optimism impresses me. In other words, your assumption is that until the Purim Suda, they're not going to be exposed to anything. And it's only just the Purim Suda in your house. Well, I have a very simple recommendation. Have one bottle of whatever your favorite wine is. And wine is better than any type of, other alcoholic beverages. And have small glasses and give it out. And don't be so frum and don't worry about Adel or Yoda. Not for yourself, if that's going to make the difference for your children, and not for your children. But I think the problem is what happens until they get to your Sudas Purim. I know from experience that the kids that come collecting, yeshiva bochrim, that come collecting at night, right after the Megillah, I don't know when they started drinking on Titus Esther, I don't know what they did, but by the time they get to my house, I think it's the first stop, because it's like the first house in Far Rockaway, they're already inebriated. So, I don't know. I mean, I think it requires talking beforehand. It requires deal making. You know, it requires explaining how you feel it's very detrimental. It requires explaining how it has dangers. I mean, you ask any of the Hatzolah people, they'll tell you that every Purim is horrendous, horrendous. That the close calls, if hopefully only that they have every year are just like scary. So you have to have discussion about it. And it's not screaming and yelling, but maybe agreements, maybe a little bribe, maybe a little incentive, you know. And yes, we will drink a little bit at the Suda, but it has to be with moderation. And, that's really, you know, if you want, if your kid's a little more sophisticated, show them the Rambam. The Rambam says that once you're yoytze the mitzvos hayoyim, and you have extra money, you should spend it on matonos levyonim. She'ein simcha. So if you want to be happy, go out and give some more matanos. Help some people. Go do that. Help people. Or if you want to be even more sinister, help people not to drink on Purim. You know, then you'll feel good about yourself. And it's hard. It's very hard. But if you talk about it, you start talking about it now, and you offer some type of incentives, and you set a good example, and you're careful about what is available in your house, I think it would be a very a wise thing to tell a community that they should substitute grape juice and fruit juices for some of the stuff that they send shalachmonas and and this old fashioned used to be. I remember the day still when somebody comes with shalachmonas for the little kids, you give some candy, and for the adult, you pour a drink. They have to know the dangers and have to be mispal. Yes. Okay, that question is a very valid question. Like, how come there's such a tremendous amount of at-risk and at-risk behavior, which seems to be much more than ever before in memorable history? Okay, but that refers to a lot of different things. That refers to people, it's today ain't bayish, ain't bo-mason. It's a little worse today. Let me just try to answer that. It is a little bit. It certainly seems a little worse. I would like to say that our success is the cause of this problem. You see, years ago we weren't as successful as an establishment. We fought to make yeshivas and day schools. We fought to get students. We fought to fill classes. We welcomed everyone into our school. Today, it's a whole different story. We are the establishment. We are very demanding. We are far less tolerant than ever before. And the message that has come out from our community is, you're not good enough. Don't feel good about yourself because you're really not. And that's really something that's devastating. If there was one area, I think that is certainly valid. The other thing, as I mentioned before, is pressure. There never was so much pressure for Yiddishkeit as there is today. We were more laid back. I'm embarrassed to tell my children some of the stuff that I ate when I was a kid. There was, you read the ingredients, and if you were real frum, you sent a letter to the manufacturer, and you got a letter back, and it said that there were no this, that, or the other thing. I still remember sitting in the room waiting to speak to Rav Henkin, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, when Beryl Levy was inside the room there, talking to him about the fact that he wants to give a hechsher on Coca-Cola on Pesach, and the only thing, they wouldn't tell him what the secret ingredients were, the only thing they would tell him were that there's nothing, no chometz there. They would sign on all the possible ingredients that wouldn't be permitted today it's so what has happened is there's a tremendous sense of pressure today. There's much less, far less acceptance. I mean, the kinds of things. Look at some of the old pictures. See the way people used to dress. See the way they dress now. See the way Gedolei Yisrael of the last generation dressed when they were young teenagers. And, so all of these things have created such a pressure. Some are flourishing, and some are just buckling under the pressure. And it's I think these are some of the things that are going on. I think also and I hate to say this, but I think it's very true. The learning, as much as it has increased, the excitement in learning, the in-depth in learning, the challenge in learning. See, learning years ago used to be much more interactive. There were small classes. The Rebbe would argue with the Talmidim. Today, it's like, the class is very big. You can't talk too much. It's mostly we've gone to lecture format. And the consequences are there isn't that excitement. There isn't that enjoyment. There isn't that involvement. And maybe that also, I think, these are some of the factors that may contribute to that phenomenon. Yes?
I'm not interested at all, but what I have to do with my kids' friends do. And not let me think my kids go to play with
them. Well, you see, here's a very difficult thing. If you start interfering with your kids' ability to play with their friends, you're asking for trouble. On the other hand, if they get involved in that, you got trouble. So it's a very hard thing. I think that it's probably more about education, explaining to them the way you feel about something, explaining to them how you feel it's inappropriate, how you feel it's dangerous, rewarding them for their honesty with you, and that's very important, not to force them into a position where they're going to hide from you and do all kinds of things, and for staying away from these things. But it's very, very difficult. It brings to mind, I remember we lived in an out-of-town community for many years, and our kids had friends, and they couldn't. When we got there, it was a very schwach community, and you couldn't not have them go to friends. And they knew that they weren't allowed to eat anything by their friends' houses. So one day, my little kid, so high, comes back and says, "Oh, I had something. It was schnitzel, but it was just like the schnitzel you make," she told my wife. So you got a problem. It's definitely a problem that I think encouraging them to recognize and offering them alternatives. The more fun that they can have in other ways, the less they're going to need that. And I guess you have to make them feel, and it's not a normally good way of chinuch, but you have to make them feel a certain gaiva, a certain ego that, you know, we're trying to stay above that stuff, you know, and a pride rather than a restriction. A build up rather than a put down. And it's not to put down the friends. You know, friends have it and people need it and people have different, but this is what we're trying to do. And that's not really the answer, but that's the best that I could do. It's very difficult. Yes?
You said to never say, "Because I said so." Mm-hmm. Can it be a situation where the child just can't understand the reason and you're confident that you're doing it for his own good?
Yes. Absolutely. My feeling is that even if they can't understand the reason, if you explain a reason, then even if they don't get it, but they heard there is a reason, somebody believes that there is a reason, and that also makes it easier. So I said so. Because I said so, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You know, who are you? That's the attitude. But if you know, this, I don't get, you know, listen, we'll discuss it again in 6 months. You'll understand it better. But I have given a reason. There's a reason, and the reason must always be for my benefit. That's, I think, the key. Yes?
When you talk about pressure, it seems to me, without any experience, that pressure is a very good thing. That's the drive. If someone wants to come, give two examples. You want to learn daf yomi. So you got to finish that daf every day. Someone wants to learn Kveiyitim L'Torah. He has to learn for that hour every day.
What do you do if you really didn't finish the daf that day? You what fake do, it.
What does who do?
I don't mean you.
Yeah.
I mean, pressure is definitely, for example, let's say if you want to teach someone to reach high. So the chokhmah is to put it in a way that with effort they could reach, but not beyond their grasp. Some of the pressure places the results that we seem to be looking for beyond their grasp. If it's gentle pressure that leads them to grow gradually, it can be a healthy thing. But if it's something that you're going to push me and over, you must touch the ceiling.
Show them that they can do it.
Can't. Try. Show me. Come on. You can't. You want to tell me I must touch this? See, I did it.
Is it something?
But this I can't.
We're talking about something you want.
The way our children are internalizing the pressure as beyond their capability.
So you say,
because you're never satisfied.
Why not?
I don't know why you're never satisfied, but you're never satisfied. That's what your kids tell me.
You make the goal on something that you can attain.
Oh, that's 100%.
And you make it pressure.
100. And you make it what?
Make it pressure.
No, you don't have to make it pressure. You make it challenging. When you put too much pressure, you know what a pressure cooker is? You put too much pressure, it explodes. They can't take it.
Lower the heat.
You have to lower the heat.
We got pressure.
Okay. There's enough pressure. I see one thing. If you lower the pressure, they'll still have plenty of pressure. you're right, pressure. But that's not called pressure. See, hechruch. Hechruch is important. Pressure is overwhelming. There's a certain level of, I'm pushing too much. I can't get it. It seems, or I internalize it, it's beyond what I can reach. I just fall on my face. If I will try to reach the top there, I'm going to fall flat on my face.
That's a different issue. That you're telling the child to reach the ceiling when he can.
Many of our children today, most of our children today, feel that they're being told to reach the ceiling. They're feeling their deviation is not acceptable. Mistakes are not acceptable. Okay, then it's just a matter of the language that we're using. Kids have to feel that they could take their time, that they have to get there, but they're not to be overwhelmed in the process. Some will go faster, some will go slower. Each person will go according to his capability. And then a little bit, you know, a little push, but not something that just overwhelms me. We're really not disagreeing too much.
You mentioned before the idea of picking up a family pride about certain ideas. So what if we have, let's say, eight out of nine kids feel it's very proud of it, and one of them is very resentful towards being a little bit different. Most of them look at it like it's a pride, and they want it. But every time you do that, there's one child who kind of feels okay because of that.
Yeah, this is the problem that we all have in families and with the peers and... you probably, in that situation, have to find other ways of rewarding this kid. And if, for example, a kid like that I don't know all the technology, but could have something that's very enjoying and very upgradable in terms of, you know, some of these games or something that they do, that's something that remains within the realm of what we find acceptable, then it'll be easier for them. You know, you don't have that, we don't have that, you don't agree completely, but I keep making sure that you have stuff to keep yourself busy, to keep yourself happy, and, you know, and that with explanation and with constantly looking for alternatives and sharing with the child, listen, that's terrible, it's dangerous, I know what it is, it's bad. Let's find, what alternative do you want? Here, you know, I'm willing to spend money, I'm willing to get you something. Oftentimes you could, you know.
The school rules are against all of these types of things?
I don't know. The school rules, what, are there any other schools in town? I don't know. There must be something the school permits. And then he says there's no pressure. I don't know. You got to find something. Sports? Is that? Do you know, the Gemara says, someone again, the same one who told me this, Menorah Samor, told me a Gemara, he said in Yuma, Ein Ches, I think, with Rovo, they bought things for their kids to break. Something, Rashi explains, what? I don't remember what it is, but something like they needed the exercise, they got them, the kid, they had to let out this energy, and, you know, so you have to find things like that. There must be something that's, if there's nothing that's permissible. You know, that was something we heard from many. I remember Yankov Kamenetsky all the time talked about the Kinder dürfen spielen. You know, that's what they need. Look, Reb Chaim Moser brought a goat into the cheder. You know, he had a blast. You know, so I don't know. Yes. Okay, it's a problem. So you may have to set up a fund to be able to provide all of them. I don't know. Listen, I wish there were simple answers, but I can tell you one thing. To the degree that you start early, that you talk about it, that you make them feel good about themselves, they have the strength to weather more frustration. The better a person feels about himself, that I'm choshev, I'm valid, I'm important, and therefore I feel happy, the more koiches that they will find from within to face the specific frustration that they have in this particular situation. It's the kid that really feels rotten about himself to begin with that's going to make your life miserable because of something that he wants and he can't have. The other kid will be able to, some way you'll be able to communicate that type of an adjustment. Oh, yeah, I have another. Yes? Is what?
Taking advantage of the trust and lying.
Lying?
Lying to you, betraying your trust.
Uh-huh.
At what point does it end and how do you confront them on that?
Okay, so first of all, I think that the question is about a child who takes advantage of this, believing in that you show them, and they lie to you and do other things that breach that trust. I think that it's probably very solid advice that from the earliest stages of development, lying should be something that's not tolerated. Truth should be forever constantly rewarded, and lying should be something that just can't exist. And I'll tell you why. Because if you're dealing with any problem, if there's honest communication, you got a chance. If there's lying, who are you talking to? Who are you? I don't know who I'm dealing with. I don't know what I'm dealing with. And it seems to me that from the earliest stages, and it requires, by the way, parents to be brutally honest, not the kid answer the phone and say, oh, tell him that I went to Hawaii or something, you know, because you don't want to speak to the nudnik or whoever it is they're called. So, and demanding, you know, truth. This is, and it's the kind of a virtue where if you create an atmosphere in a home where a child doesn't have to be afraid to tell the truth, because it's not, if I tell the truth of the mistake that I made, you're not going to slap me in the face. You will foster an environment of truth-telling, and therefore you'll be able to deal, you know, much more with this. Now, there are other ways of taking advantage of that trust. And I think that the other ways, also, there's nothing that makes me change my opinion of you being valid, trustworthy, good, true, everything else. You have made a mistake. You're making another mistake. Just because the child, even if they're cheating on you, even if they're fooling you, so you're fooling, but you're still a good person. To the degree that we communicate, our kids learn about who they are from us in the earliest stages of life. They only start learning who they are from their peers in the teenage years, or maybe the early preteen years. But the earliest encounter with themselves comes from what their parents think of them. And that has to be, I'm always thinking of you good. You're always good. You've done something here that you've cheated, you've lied, you've deceived me, you've breached the trust. That has to be taken to task. But I know that just it's a mikre. It happened. It's something that's unusual. It's unlikely that it'll ever happen again. I don't believe it's ever going to happen again. And when it happens a second time, so it's more serious, but that attitude will eventually, I believe, communicate to the kid, I am good, I am trustworthy, and that will minimize, not eliminate, there's no absolutes in this business, but it will minimize, I think, the negative impact. Okay, Kol Tov.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.